Not ready? Too bad. Head back, face forward, and hold on like you mean it.
Welcome to Review Time's Theme Park Cast, a weekly podcast where we explore the ins and outs of attractions and theme parks from around the world. This week, we discuss the history and current standing of Luna Park Sydney, or Sydney's Luna Park. They seem to change the name constantly, but it wouldn't be Review Time's Theme Park Cast if I wasn't joined by the Mask Crusader Vigilante, the one scouring reviews of theme parks we love online to protect them from the one-star reviews complaining about the weather, which is apparently entirely the park's fault. It's Review Time's co-host, Luke Carroll.
Now, this might be slightly telling of the two of us and the type of people that we are and kind of just how boring our lives are, but I remember one of our favorite things to do used to be going to TripAdvisor, finding a theme park we really liked, and then laughing at the one-star reviews and like how ludicrous they were.
We would basically go to the one-star reviews and be like, look at these idiots.
Yeah, pretty much.
It sounds much more harsh than we actually are, but it's those things where you see people who are complaining about the weather, maybe they're complaining about the crowd levels and things like that, and those are outside of the park's control. I get it if you're at a quiet park and there's still really long waits, but if you're at Tokyo Disney Sea and there's a 40-minute wait in one of the busiest theme parks in the world, that's actually not a bad wait.
Yeah. And I feel it's as well, the things you do as an Australian whilst you wait for your next theme park trip, those are kind of, you know, you're getting quite a while since you've been to a theme park and you're just trying to find other ways to entertain the theme park part of your brain. Like, that's when you get to the depths of the one-star TripAdvisor trawl.
If you've got a Disney trip coming up, there's only so much Tim Tracker that you can watch before you just, like, know those parks in and out. So...
Especially now, like, it used to be, well, you know, before everything changed, it was like, oh, 90 days out, I'm going to book my dining. 60 days out, I'm going to book my fast passes. 30 days out, I'm going to do all of this. Where now, if you can go, which not many people can, there's none of that to do anymore. Just pretty much rock up, wear a mask. That's your two things you need to do nowadays. I saw yesterday Epcot's average wait time for the entire day was 12 minutes. And the longest anything got all day was Test Track at one point of the day hit 30 minutes.
Wow. Which See, is like I remember when I was at Walt Disney World during what they considered the quiet season. This was
Which
20...
it was this time of year, right?
Like, yeah, it was this time of year in 2019. So I got married in early February and then pretty much straight after we got married, we went on our honeymoon. And we went there and it was busier than when I went there during the busy season of a couple years before. And I was talking to a bus driver there and he was like, I've worked for Disney World for 45 years. And he's like, a sign of the times being good is how many people are at Walt Disney World. And it's like, economically, the world was in a pretty good way before COVID. And now
and I feel as well, it becomes that as people get kind of savvier, and they, you know, watch reviews or look up, you know, touring plans and websites like that, they suddenly go, when is the quietest time to go to Walt Disney World in Google? Ah, January. Let's go in January because we know how crazy it is. And it kind of becomes the busy period. The same thing happened to me when I went to Disneyland in 2019. I went in summer, which was meant to be like, you know, eights or nines out of tens in crowd levels. And it was dead because I think people were scared that it was going to be so busy. They would go when they expected it to be quiet and it almost flipped on its head. And it'll be interesting to see what settles as the new busy period when all of this craziness finishes, especially during the 50th at Walt Disney World. But we don't need to worry about that today.
No.
Because even if we can't go overseas, even for the next 3 years, one park we probably can go to is Luna Park Sydney, so take it away.
Well, it's really quiet at the moment for one reason, that the park's closed. So for some context for those who have, I guess, somehow this made like international theme park news.
Which doesn't happen usually in Australia.
Like,
this, when it was starting to come out, I'm like, this is Luna Park, guys. Like, yeah, I have always loved the times that I've gone to Luna Park. I don't think I've ever really had a bad day, except for maybe the hour after I rode the power surge at Luna Park Sydney the last time we went. We'll touch on that a little bit later on our last visit, which was, as you said, 3 days ago.
Yep.
But I always have a good time here. It's a good park, I think. Yeah, it's definitely...
It is what it is.
It's, yeah. You can't go here expecting, you know, Disney-style theming or, you know,
even
movie
Universal-style theming.
Yeah, like, you can't expect the scope of somewhere like Dreamworld or Movie World because it just doesn't have the space. And I guess that comes with expectation. Like, your expectations are always tapered by Luna Park because it is just a smaller plot of land. For those that don't know, Luna Park Sydney literally sits on Sydney Harbour as like a boardwalk theme park. It overlooks, well, not overlooks, it underlooks. It's on the harbour, so it's under.
It looks so, I guess.
The harbour bridge is very big, and it pretty much sits just under it. So you have this amazing view of the harbour bridge. You've got this amazing view of the Opera House, which for a second there, I was about to forget the name, and I was probably about to lose my citizenship. But yeah, it's a really good theme park. But something as well, this park has huge historical significance. This like this park is centuries old. Well, actually, I think
not
we're just
centuries,
under,
but
just under a century. But if we talk about how Sydney Luna Park came to be, I guess we have to take it back to around 1924. So they started planning the Harbour Bridge a little bit before that. It was in 1916 where they were like, we need a big bridge to bridge the gap in Sydney Harbour.
Which if you haven't been to Sydney, Sydney Harbour Bridge, especially back then, now there's a few other options, but it pretty much separates the city of Sydney from the north and the south nowadays. It's like, get across the bridge, you're in North Sydney. On the other side, you're in the CBD or area like that. For me, you know, the Sydney Harbour Bridge is pretty much just a part of my everyday life if I need to get to Sydney, because I am on the north side, and that is where Luna Park is. Exactly as you were saying, Luna Park probably has the best view of any theme park in the world. I don't know, maybe something like Mount Fuji for a natural beauty, but still, Luna Park, sitting right there on the water's edge, you have that nice breeze blowing off the water. You look, you can see the Harbour Bridge, you can see the CBD, you can see the Opera House, you can see how expansive the harbour is. On a beautiful day, you would struggle to beat that view.
Oh, 100%. There are maybe a couple of theme parks that I can think have that same sort of tier of view. Mm. Like if I think Ocean Park at Hong Kong, because it's right on the top of a mountain, has amazing sweeping views of the backside of Hong Kong, but you can't exactly see the entire city as you can from Luna Park if you're on the Ferris wheel or if you're on the giant drop type thing, mini drop. It's about half the size.
It's like 50 meters, I think.
Yeah. But
which, when there's nothing kind of around, like, it gets
It feels tall.
Yeah. And especially you start rising, and if you there's probably half of that ride has a really good view of the Harbour Bridge. It's probably one of the best views of the Harbour Bridge you're going to get anywhere in Sydney. For, you know, a split second before you plummet back down to Earth.
Yeah. Well, let's give some sort of context for those that don't know, because I know we have a lot of American viewers. Luna Park Sydney literally sits right on the harbour. It's surrounded entirely by a suburb called Milson Point, and that's mostly just residential. So right behind Luna Park, you've got all of these apartments. They're all looking over. That has caused significant problems for the history of the theme park, which we'll get into, because people don't particularly like living literally overlooking a theme park. There
and
used to be a point.
Screams all day.
Yeah,
but
where there was
going to discover.
There was a,
the theme park was there first. Whether it was open or not when they bought their apartment, The theme park has been there at this stage for 85 years almost.
Which is essentially what the government has concluded recently, because there were lots of lawsuits back and forth. It was that thing of, like, you know, no, Luna Park needs to be quieter. And then Luna Park was like, no, the people in Milsons Point, they need to stop complaining. And eventually got to the point where the government's like, look, you chose to live near a theme park. And
yeah,
you know, so what do you expect? Luna Park has a lot of strict rules regarding how much noise it can make.
Built, heights.
But it's...
Yeah.
Instead of it going through, like, the local people, they just have a bunch of regulations that they have to stick through, and it goes through the government. So
and it gets
the people don't really have
automatic.
A say, but they can
There's
have
no
the
tendering
respect.
Exactly. There's no kind of community input anymore. You know how previously they would have to say, oh, we plan to build this, and it would go to communities who would say, no, 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 sort of thing. Where now... The community doesn't get a chance to say no, 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 no because of the agreement they have with the government. Because I believe that Luna Park doesn't own the land it's on. It's this agreement they have with the kind of the government to operate the park. So it's not even as if they could sell the land for anything else.
Yeah.
It is designated to be a theme park. So,
and how it started back in the day is when they actually started... making the Harbour Bridge, and why we were talking about it before and why it's sort of significant to the plot of Luna Park, is they needed a staging area for all of the manufacturing, bringing in the iron. The Harbour Bridge is absolutely ginormous. It's hard to understand just how big that bridge is until you drive over it. But they needed somewhere to put all of the resources and the manpower and the people who were welding and, you know, if people were just having breaks. So they created this little area where all of the warehouses was, and that would eventually become the plot for Luna Park Sydney. Because once the bridge was done, they just tore everything down and left this plot there. And they were kind of like, who wants to do something here? And there were a couple of suggestions here and there, but eventually what they landed on was opening Luna Park, which is based off the original Coney Island theme park from, I believe it's 1905, which was back in New York, or maybe it's earlier than that.
Well, I believe, so Australia being, you know, classically behind the times, in US especially, the 1920s, known as the Roaring Twenties, were quite big for theme parks, and you know, that was the thing to do, you know, theme parks, themed entertainment shows, vaudeville, all that was around this time. And it'd be very much that Australia looked to the US and went, hey, we want something like that here. And you know, this isn't the first Luna Park in Australia. We've got Luna Park Melbourne, which opened 1912. And then Luna Park Gonnell, which opened in 1930. But ours in Sydney, the Melbourne one's still running, and as is the Sydney one. Melbourne one actually has the world's oldest operating roller coaster. So yeah, the Sydney, Melbourne, and Glenel Luna Park were all based off the Coney Island 1903 New York Luna Park. And Sydney and Melbourne still operate to this day. I don't believe Glenel does. Melbourne, interestingly, has the world's longest operating roller coaster. It's some weird thing where it's not technically the oldest, but it's the oldest that's been continually operating. Like, whatever's the oldest closed for a large period of time sort of thing, where the Melbourne has continued to run. So it makes it, there's something to go to for, you know, something to go to. We have never been, but one day I'm sure we'll get there to see it.
We have always intended to go there, and I know there was a point where there were heaps of Luna Parks around the country. There was one in Adelaide, I believe, as well.
Yeah, the Glenel.
I don't know where Glenel is. I know where Adelaide is. But I heard of it because whenever I go to a new place, I always look up. I'm like, where's theme parks? So... this Luna Park Sydney, I'm not sure if you mentioned this before, opened up in 1935 in its first iteration. And we will mention there have been a lot of iterations of this theme park. So the Sydney Harbour Bridge opened in like 1932. And then 3 years down the line, we had Sydney's Luna Park. When it first opened, it was, you know, this fantasy architecture in an Art Deco style of the 1930s. It was this... It was a really cool theme. It was what Coney Island was, and that's what it was trying to aspire to be. And it gave the people of Sydney something to do, especially it had an immediate success because it used a lot of rides from the other theme parks around Australia when they brought all of them in. And it ran pretty smoothly for a couple of decades, which is surprising considering that as you get later into Luna Park's history is when it gets really rocky. And I think a lot of that has to do with comparisons. Like if we look at Luna Park back in the day for the people of Australia was something brand new. Like we think of theme parks now, you've got Movie World and SeaWorld, all of those, but they've only come about in like the 70s, 80s and 90s. This was around since the 30s. Yeah. So
this was theme parks at the time, this style, this boardwalk style theme park, which Luna Park Sydney is one of the few kind of remaining ones in the world that, and it still kind of sticks to that Art Deco theming in a lot of it. Like it's got this, still got this feel of emulating this 1930s boardwalk theme park. Whilst it doesn't necessarily do it too much in the attractions nowadays, but very much so in just the feel of the park. And you know, places like the Crystal Palace and Coney Island obviously have this feel of being from another time.
One of my favorite things about this initial period, which was between 1935 and 1969, when it was first operated by showman David Atkins, who operated until 1957, and then engineer Ted Hopkins operated until 1969. But if you think about this time period, this is around when the Second World War was going on.
Yeah.
There was a major significant event happening, kind of like the major significant event we're going through right now. I sure would like to stop through these major worldwide events, but we'll get there one day. Maybe we can have some time of relaxation without any huge newsworthy happenings.
Well, I did hear that analysts think that by 2023, Disney parks will be busier than they were in 2019 as a sort of... people going, oh, well, I've couldn't do anything for 3 years, so time to splurge.
Well, I have this theory, which I'm not sure a lot of people have accommodated for. The demand, once all of the countries in the world go, all right, COVID, it's done. We're good. Most of the world's vaccinated. We're ready to go. Demand for flights, cruise ships, just any form of transport is going to go, woo! That's upwards, not down.
for those listening. That was a rising tone. I feel that showed what you were going for.
And I think a lot of people, they're like, I've saved up $5,000 or $10,000 over the coronavirus for those privileged enough to still be able to work. And we do understand that a lot of people aren't in that situation at the moment. And for those who are struggling, definitely in our thoughts, and we're really sorry that these things are happening. But for those that have been saving, it's going to be that huge problem of demand will be so high that, you know, you still have to factor in airlines need to hire back people. Disney needs to hire back people. There's going to be this huge influx of jobs, but then you got to train them. You got to get the workforce under par. You've got to get the infrastructure up and running. It's just going to be a hodgepodge for like, I think a couple of years until things stable out. There are going to be some very lucky people.
I think we were lucky that before all this happened, we were kind of in, I don't want to say a golden age for transport, but it had kind of evened out. If you think of when I was growing up and when you were growing up, how much it would have been to get to Los Angeles on a plane, you would be, $1,400, $1,500. Where last time I went to LA, I got return flights for $900. And that's not taking into account, inflation on that $1,500 that it used to be to get to LA. I think it'll almost be a weird thing, I feel, where at the start, it might not be stupidly expensive. It's going to be more expensive, but I don't think it'll be, you know, like $5,000 to get to US. It might be, instead of 900, it might be 1200. But then as more of the population starts to get comfortable with everything going on and starts to recoup their savings, in a few years' time, we might be seeing it astronomically expensive to travel.
Well, you've got to factor in as well, you know, the fact that people still need to get leave, people need to organize families and all that. Not many people have the privilege of just going, all right, borders are open, let's go the next day.
Yeah, there are, exactly.
Like, we're in that thankful position of we, as Review Time, have been saving a lot for the potential of going on trips because, you know, our entire business model revolves around reviewing things. So we kind of need to review things. So we are in that lucky circumstance where when things reopen, we will be ready to go.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of people won't have that because it's just too much of a logistical nightmare to try and organize something within a week. However, I did have
even
a weird dream.
For some people.
Yeah. It's like, getting a family together is just going to be difficult enough. Yeah. You have to get them out of school. You have to wait for the right time.
Exactly,
so I think there are only going to be select groups that will be able to do something immediately. I also had a really weird dream the other night. This is a little bit of a tangent, where I was hanging out with you in Sydney, like what I did the other day. Mm. But then you and all of like the boys, all of our guy friends were like, let's go to Japan. And I was like, we can't. There are restrictions. And you're like, nah, it's fine. So we literally that day, like, booked flights to Japan. Oh. And I got over to Japan. I'm there. And we were seeing, like, the Olympics. But the Olympics events were, like, dolphins shooting lasers at each other. And I'm in this stadium. And then I call up my family. I'm like, hey, I'm in Japan. They're like, what are you doing? The coronavirus is still around. And it's as if I forgot. And I was like, oh, I'm such an idiot. So I flew back. And then everyone was really angry at me.
So, you fool. Don't you
strange
remember?
Dream. But it was very vivid.
That's a strange one.
Also, sure. Zavala from Destiny 2 was riding one of the dolphins.
I wish this dream came true then. I do know. Yeah, it's definitely going to be a weird time with the Olympics, as you're saying, this year. Who knows what's going to happen there? I feel really bad for Japan because they kind of from. Do you remember when they first, like, the first thing where it was going to be Tokyo and they had, like, Mario there and the president came out of like a Mario pipe to get the torch from the previous Olympics and all of that. And just even obviously just knowing us in the theme park realm, knowing how much parks had pumped, you know, new expansions to open last year for the Olympics with that expected huge surge of guests that unfortunately at this stage may never come. And it worries me for, you know, things are bad enough in the world. Imagine what, you know, the economy of Japan's going to be like after all this is over, if they had sunk all this money into the Olympics and they're not going to recuperate much of it back.
The unfortunate reality of the Olympics is that oftentimes you don't make a lot of money from it.
You go into the Olympics knowing that you may not make money, but you're going to put your country out there on the world stage. It's designed to sell your country. Maybe not then in that exact moment, but hopefully for years to come and over time, like Sydney, I feel has utilized their facilities that were created for the Olympics quite well. And you know, there's constant sports games and concerts and stuff like that at those venues. And, you know, in the last 21 years, they've probably made their money back from what it cost them to build. There's obviously a lot more to be lost if you don't have the Olympics at all, but you've already paid for everything.
100%. And I think a lot of the bigger controversy comes when you have, unfortunately, poorer countries that host the Olympics, which end up using the infrastructure. You know, they build the infrastructure with government funds that realistically should be going back to the people, but that's a whole nother thing. Let's bring it back to Luna Park. So being open between 1935 and 1969, it was open during the Second World War. And there's some really interesting things about this, because Luna Park was essentially like, it just attracted servicemen. So people who would just go there to treat their girlfriends to a night out, or they would go there looking to meet someone. Like, it was this perfect young person meeting
Tinder
ground.
Tinder in the 1940s
pretty much. Naughty Tinder, which I'll get into soon. But some interesting things. The park's external lights are actually, like, browned out at night in case of a Japanese sneak attack on Sydney. The neon
did
lights
happen at one point. Japan did get attacked by Japanese midget submarines in the 1940s. So
wait, Sydney?
Luna Park, yeah,
you said Japan was attacked by the Japanese.
Oh, sorry, Sydney was Sydney Harbour.
Japan was attacked by the Japanese. they had the neon lights were disconnected. Any non-essential uses of electricity, primarily the ride facades, were curtailed. And also, my favorite fun fact, the influx of servicemen drew prostitutes to the area.
Oh, naughty Tinder.
And large-scale brawls were commonplace for the actual Luna Park, which is understandable because you would have both, like, American sailors on shore leave and you'd have Australian Home Defence Forces. You just have young men in a confined space with young women. Yeah, pretty much like, hey, you want to fight me, see? Except it was probably like,
that's what all 1940s men were like, right?
A little bit of fisticuffs. So it was under lease for a little while. And then it sort of hit the 70s and things started to get a bit rocky.
For the first time.
Yeah, so essentially, in the early 1970s, a group of artists were commissioned to redecorate the park. It was starting to get a little bit old at this point. But then it hits 1975 and the lease expires with the park continuing to operate. But they can't negotiate a long-term lease agreement, which means that you can't exactly do much if you can't think
of
the long
term. You can't plan for the future if you're just going on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah.
What can you do? Like, you may literally be kicked out tomorrow. Why would you worry about, you know, investing in new things or upkeep or anything if you think you're going to be kicked out next week?
Yeah. And so this starts to bring in the more portable nature of Luna Park. Something really interesting about Luna Park is that it sort of brings in attractions here and there that are portable attractions, the things
even
that you'd expect to see at fun
fairs. Even a lot of their permanent attractions were just portable rides they had permanently plonked down on a plot of land. Like rides that were designed to travel that sat there for 30 years at a time.
Yeah, and sometimes they'll put down a portable ride with long-term intentions and just not ask permission, which is very fun. Luna Park is very risky, which they sort
very
of...
very ask for forgiveness rather than permission.
Yeah. So, they're during this sort of lull period, and the park starts to decline a bit until it hits a point where, unfortunately, following a fatal fire on the ghost train on the 9th of June, 1979, and the park is closed. So, that was bad, but it wasn't the worst, it was the worst thing to happen that year, but it wasn't the only bad thing to happen that year. Yeah. 1979 was not a good year for Luna Park. On the 16th of April, so only about a month or two earlier, 13 people were injured on the Big Dipper roller coaster. A steel runner had come loose, halting one of the three roller coaster trains, and it just rammed into this. Like, there was one stationary and there was another in motion. It just rammed it. So similar to the Smiler incident.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good time. The ghost train fire is incredibly tragic. There were lots of young people who perished, some people who weren't even over the age of 10. Respectfully, they do have a memorial to that
event within the park,
which is very tasteful. It's a little plaque featured near the Big Top.
Which is in the similar position to what the ghost train used to be. Because even the park is quite different today to even in layout-wise than it used to be. Kind of nowadays, half, or I would say a quarter of the park is taken up by a large-scale venue facility entitled the Big Top, which is just kind of a big sort of empty space that you can fill with stages or theater seats. When I had worked at Luna Park a couple of years back for their Halloween event, the scare mazes were built in the Big Top area, sort of thing. And this Big Top is where this ghost train used to be, because back in these days, it did have more of what we think of as the classic sort of that era theme park attractions, like a ghost train and a Noah's Ark walkthrough experience and the River Caves boat ride. And it had all of these classics of the time that aren't really anywhere today. And unfortunately, they don't survive either at Luna Park Sydney today. Even though in style, it still has that very 1930s feel. Mm. It's adapted and grown since then in its attraction offerings. And as we'll talk about later, it's definitely growing a lot this year.
Yeah. So this is when things start to get very rocky for the theme park, because as of 1979, they immediately shut down the theme park. The government steps in. They're like, nah. So there was a coronial inquest, which was unable to establish the cause of the fire, which ended up causing, I believe it was the 9 people to perish. I think there were about 9 to 12, a couple of children. So 6 children and one adult from what I can see here. As you can imagine, this is not the part I like to research. So I'm trying to be very respectful, but it's my first time touching on something like this. So they concluded that Luna Park managers and operators had failed in their duty of care towards the park's patrons. And so pretty much they just said, nah, get up, you're gone. At that point, they were looking for tenders to operate the theme park to try and keep it going. Two rounds of tenders just failed to produce any satisfactory results for both the government and the applicants. And a third round of tenders was called in March of 1980. So it was already closed for a year at that point. But as it kept going, as they were going on, the citizens were starting to get concerned. At this point, Luna Park had a pretty stable history. Apart from the accident of the Big Dipper and the ghost train, because there was no widespread, social media or anything like that, people didn't necessarily understand the severity of these events and that it was Luna Park at fault. So a lot of people were still in favor of Luna Park, and there were protests that were organized, such as Save Luna Park. This was a whole march that went from the Opera House to the face of the park, the big giant.
Which is quite a walk, because you have to go across the Harbour Bridge.
Oh, yeah, it was huge.
That's a march. That's a real march.
And it finished with a free concert at the end, so that they could essentially bring awareness to the fact that the park was in real bad ways. One of the results of this actually going into government, essentially administration, was that a lot of the park became, part of the National Trust. The government now had a stake in Luna Park, and they were able to bring it in as sort of heritage buildings. So the Luna Park face was now an item of national heritage, and the rest of Luna Park was given a recorded classification, which I think just means it's
terrifying face.
Yeah.
So it's not as scary today as it has been throughout history. If you go into the park and you go into the Coney Island area, they've got quite a few older pictures of the park looking at what it looked like over the years. And some of them do make you go, dang, that looks really cool. But some of them are terrifying. The pictures of, they've had like six or eight faces over the years. And some of them look really fun and inviting. And some of them look like the entrance to a horror museum. Like, they look like they're melting or, you know, something like that.
If you had, like, you know, smoke effects and fire, it would look like literally the entrance to some sort of spooky Halloween event. Like the dismal land from Banksy, essentially.
Yeah.
But at this point, you know, things were pretty bad. The Big Dipper roller coaster, which at this stage, I believe, was the wooden roller coaster iteration, not the steel.
The original Big Dipper, I'd imagining?
Yeah, which was like one of the main things that brought people to the park. It was just gigantic. Well, not gigantic. It was pretty big for the Sydney Harbour, but it was a wooden roller coaster right on the harbour's edge. Pretty much in 1981, the original park was just basically flattened. Anything that was detachable was auctioned off. But other than that, it was just... And they just went through and they just bulldozed a majority of it, except for, I believe, the face at the front.
Yeah.
So in 1981, the Luna Park site bill was passed, which meant Luna Park Holdings had to vacate the site, and Luna Park memorabilia and rides dating from 1935 to 1981 were auctioned off. So this pretty much ended the first iteration of Luna Park. It was just gone. There was pretty much nothing left. Everything was just stripped apart, sold, auctioned. And I think it was what was necessary after what happened.
Fresh start.
You can't really recover from an accident like what they had, especially when it was found that they were at fault. Mm-hmm. So at that point, they started taking interest in the new tenders. But I think we'll just quickly have a break and then we'll jump back into it.
Let's do it.
And we are back. So, Luke, the year is 1982.
I'm not even born Sydney. Yet.
Oh, you're a dust. A glimmer space in space dust.
What is a glimmer in a parent's eye or something? Isn't that the saying?
Like a sparkle in your mother's smile. So, at this point, a new leaseholder had been appointed to Luna Park. So, Luna Park's coming back. You're going to get
that
a whole
short,
new...
That was a quick turnaround.
Well, it was closed from... It was 1979. It was then demolished in 1981. So, they then came back and they were like in May of 1982, they reopened with a mix of new and reconditioned rides. So this was similar to when Luna Park originally opened with sort of a mixture of different attractions. This was just whatever they had at the time.
We're back.
However, now that you're back, we got to close again. Just 6 years later in 1988, the park would close for renovation after an unsuccessful attempt to redevelop the site as an adult entertainment center with high-rise towers.
What is an adult entertainment center, and do I want to know?
I'm not entirely sure, but it sounds interesting. It doesn't really elaborate on it all that much. Yeah. This is the timeline from Luna
Hopefully
Park
not
that's
a
available.
Throwback to the 40s with the naughty Tinder that was going on in the park.
Bring back the war and the prostitutes. So on June of 1990, the lease is terminated through the Luna Park Site Act of 1990. Like, legislation was just going through fast to just kick people off this block.
Just likes to go, no, let's try somebody else instead.
You can imagine, because this isn't like some theme park in the middle of Outback Sydney. This is your prime time real estate. This is literally part of the identity of Sydney Harbour.
Yeah.
So, of course, you know, the government has a stake in this because they're like, is the identity of the theme park. So after it closed in 1988 for a renovation to essentially try and turn it into an adult entertainment center, and looking into that, I think they're sort of leaning more towards what you would imagine downtown Disney to be like, not, you know, sex heaven. Like something more of like, you know, more with restaurants and bars, that sort of thing on the Sydney Harbour with maybe a couple of rides, which would have been cool.
It's a good location for it, for sure.
But unfortunately, it wasn't exactly what the area needed and I think what the government wanted. So on the 5th of June, 1990, the lease is terminated from the Lunar Park Site Act.
Again.
After the leaseholder fails to meet a deadline to reopen the theme park. So at this point, they're pretty much like, look, you got to do something. And so through the Lunar Park Reserve Trust, they managed to take control and a heritage study is commissioned. So major restoration of the historic buildings begins in 1933. And a new public forum.
Hey, we're finally alive for this part.
Yeah. So we're starting to get into our time period. So I think at this point they realized, you know, there is a lot of significance in Lunar Park. There is a lot of benefit to it existing within Sydney. So they start to restore the old buildings. They give the new, like, around the park itself, they add a new foreshore boardwalk. And they also add a new roller coaster and a couple of other rides are installed. So this is when we get to the second iteration of the Big Dipper. The first one is a wooden roller coaster and the second one is a steel roller coaster, which, fun
this
fact...
This one you can still ride.
Yeah.
Just not at Lunar Park Sydney anymore.
It exists at Dream World, of all places.
Yes.
There are some amazing pictures of this, like, during transport, and it's just really
strange.
Even
just the pictures of it in the park blow my mind with how, because this is a big roller coaster.
Oh, yeah.
And Lunar Park is a small parcel of land. Like it's impressive to see how they managed to fit this ride in. It's super custom. One of the most custom rides in the world because it had to start on roofs, go between buildings and everything.
That's why if you look at the coaster at Dreamworld, it's like right up high in the air. It like sort of follows this really random path, but it worked at Lunar Park. Unfortunately, the people around didn't exactly like a steel roller coaster, especially an arrow looping coaster.
It was an arrow custom looper, which... I don't know what it would have been like in its time, in its heyday, but in the times I've ridden it since then at Dreamworld, it's not in its heyday anymore. Let's say that, shall we? It's quite a painful experience. And I've ridden some Arrow custom loopers that are still quite good to this day. So I'm not sure if it is just it was so custom or, you know, it was... sitting on the seawater for a couple of years and it's been moved and relocated. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it was good when it went into this park, but it's pretty rough now.
Well, I rode a custom looper at... It was...
Magic Mountain, probably?
No, not Magic Mountain. The one on the hill at Hong Kong, I mentioned it before, Ocean Park. That was rough. It's called the Dragon. That thing will readjust your spine. If you got scoliosis, you're coming off cured. But
hooray!
So oddly enough, they add this new roller coaster between 1993 and 1994. But then in the 20th of January of 1995, it reopens to the public. So I don't think the coaster was sitting there for too long. But, you know, it was getting ready for its debut. Yeah. At this point, it's now opened... by the Lunar Park Reserve Trust and a private carnival operator. Lunar Park doesn't actually specify who it was. I'm sure if you dug into
Joylands.
It, you could find out.
Everything nowadays
but it's
seems
not
to be Joylands.
Super significant.
Like, everything, all the temporary attractions that come into the park are always Joylands nowadays.
Yeah. So, at that point, you know, the government now has a stake. They control part of this theme park and they're pretty aggressive in how they run it because they want this to do well. You know, as you can see in that period between 1935 and 1980, there was pretty much nothing happening. And then between 1980 and 1990, it was like hopping between different owners and they tried, they demolished it and reopened it and they did all of this stuff and they were throwing stuff at the wall and it wasn't sticking. So then it hits a point where in 1997, after a couple of years of operating, it's doing all right. The park's doing fine. In 1997, they amend the Lunar Park Site Act, which provides for a wider range of what they can use it for. So this adds a couple of private rooms and theatres and things like that. And the precinct of Lunar Park and its associated heritage items are classified and placed on the register of the National Estate. So now it's officially...
I believe the park is closed at this point, right?
Yes, it does.
So all of this is happening and the park closes again. People complain about the Big Dipper. And the park closes again and bows to public pressure.
I completely skipped that.
February of 1996. And then it's closed for quite a while until it reopens in 2004. And this is the iteration of the park that I kind of remember best, obviously. And this is the iteration of the park that up until last weekend was still pretty much as it was in 2004.
Well, I just want to mention here, it closed in 1996, February of 1996, but it wasn't until about 2000, 2001 that the Big Dipper was actually relocated because they were just like, who wants
unused
it?
Unused for quite a while. And sea air isn't great for coasters, especially if they're not operating. So I don't know if that maybe has something to do with the painful nature of the ride nowadays.
So in 2002, a new company called Lunar Park Sydney Pty Ltd, which is proprietary limited,
woohoo,
assumes a new 40-year lease on Lunar Park. Construction and a total refurbishment begins in 2003.
Still got 21 years left to enjoy Lunar Park.
Yeah.
Until the end of that 40-year lease.
Oh, look, if they manage to pull off what they're about to pull off in 2021, then I think they've got it for a little bit longer than that.
They might give him another 5-year extension.
Movie World's got 80 years, doesn't it, as part of their 99-year lease of the land that they used to own and then sold?
The land that they owned and then sold just so they could lease it back. I'm not going to pretend to understand business, but that seems strange to me.
So from what I understand, it was that thing. It's like, imagine like a really crappy loan. It's like, okay, I'm going to sell the land that my house sits on to you for, say, $2 million. And then over 99 years, you're going to get $4 million out of that.
Yeah.
But I get that $2 million now. So I think it was mostly one of those things where they were pretty desperate. But at the same time, ooh, that's a long time
that's
not
to...
That's
a big call.
Yeah. But so at this point, you know, it's going through construction. It's having its full refurbishments of buildings and rides until it gets approval to open on the 4th of April, 2004, where the current iteration of Lunar Park Sydney comes back, including a couple of heritage identified features, as well as a new 2000 seat big top, which you were talking about before, auditorium, on-site car park, restaurants, and a refurbished function center.
And a lot of these functions and the big top is pretty much where Lunar Park makes its money today, from what I understand.
Oh, 100%.
They make more from, you know, renting out for weddings or renting out for entertainment or bands or stuff like that than they do from the theme park.
Yeah. So it's just that thing where it's like, this is right on the water. As we're saying, like, you can have these venues within a theme park that are literally looking over the Harbour Bridge and the Sydney skyline and the Opera House. Like, you don't get that anywhere else.
It's a one-of-a-kind view, especially because, as we were saying earlier, you are on the north side of Sydney looking over the CBD. So there's not many places where, you know, you can sit right, you know, have a beer whilst overlooking the entirety of the CBD. It's a big thing where people climb the Sydney Harbour Bridge and they're like, that was awesome, but it was also really weird to see Sydney without the Harbour Bridge in my view because I was on top of it. Like, it doesn't feel like Sydney without, you know, the Harbour Bridge, the Opera House, and probably the tower, the Sydney Tower Eye.
Yeah.
You can see all three of those from Lunar Park.
That's one of the incredible things is, as you were saying, like, usually you're used to being within the city and looking out of it, but this, you look at Sydney, and that it's kind of special in that sense. Like, I never get over the views that you can see.
Yeah.
Like, it's just something special. But now we hit the point where, you know, the puck just runs and does its thing for a couple of years until we hit around, let's say, the most significant change would be in 2021. So this year, where today, the park is now closed again for probably the 18th time in its history, but...
But this time, it knows it's going to reopen. It's not a mystery. And it's the reason we went to the park the other day. We essentially, last weekend, went to say goodbye to the Luna Park Sydney we had grown up with.
Mm.
As we said earlier, the 1996, the first iteration of the park when we were alive, closed, but I wouldn't have gone to it when I was 3 years old and remember any of it, and I'm sure you're the same. So now, this is essentially the end of an era for the park we grew up with. 2004, that is when Wonderland Sydney closed. So for the last 17 years, in our formative theme park fan years, this has been the closest theme park we've had. So it's going to be really weird to see it change so dramatically. Sure, attractions have come and attractions have gone over that time. But up until recently, there were still attractions I remember riding, you know, much, much younger as a 12-year-old that I could still ride up until a couple of months ago. And then they did start to see a few rides close over the last few months, and it was kind of telling of, ooh, maybe something's going to happen. Then we saw like little markings on the ground of like, ooh, the very theme park nerdy thing where they mark out in spray paint markings on the ground and everyone freaks out.
Everyone's like, what's happening? What's happening?
But I think even we in our wildest imaginations wouldn't have thought that the expansions were going to be as big as they're going to be.
No. So Luna Park Sydney, for those who don't know, is about to get 9 new attractions. Now, a few of those are significant. A couple others are just a couple of kiddie rides and things like that. But probably one of the most significant additions is that it's about to get a single rail launched roller coaster, one of the first of its kind in the world.
No, not one of, the first launched single rail coaster in the world. The first Intamin Hot Racer. So both RMC and Intamin build these single rail coasters, but this one is going to be the first launched in the world, which is weird to say that this little tiny boardwalk amusement park 20 minutes down the road from my house is going to have a one-of-a-kind attraction in the entire world.
It still doesn't seem real. Like, I still can't picture myself going to Luna Park and being like, oh, let's ride a single rail launch roller coaster. Yeah. Like, just thinking about the park that we went to the other day compared to what's coming, like, it's getting 3 new roller coasters. They sort of do go down in scale for each one. The second one on the list is a shuttle coaster, like a reverse free fall.
Family Boomerang.
That's the name. I think a reverse free fall is that one that used to be at Dreamworld.
That's the Tower of Terror. Boomerang, isn't it?
I think so. And then there's like a little kiddie roller coaster. I think it's powered.
Yeah. Which, but do you think that park's going to go from 1 roller coaster when it closes to 4 roller coasters when it opens is wild.
It's incredible. And I think this sort of, it's a stepping stone for Luna Park, because this is a sign of what's to come. And it shows, like, you're not going to put in 9 attractions and just be like, that's it. That's it for the future. I think this is part of their master plan. It kickstarts this next iteration of Luna Park going from being a boardwalk side attraction to being an actual theme park. There are lots of things they can't touch realistically because of heritage listings and things like that. But
I feel the biggest issue they're going to have moving forward is they've got no more space.
Yeah.
Like, this is it, pretty much. They've, you know, a lot of the, they're pretty much going to have to remove something now to add something. And the stuff that's still staying as part of the park, you've got the Wooden Wild Mouse coaster, which is iconic for this park. It's one of the few left in the entire world. I can't see them getting rid of that. unless they have to. Elsewhere on site, you've got Coney Island, one of the few, if not the only one I can think. I'm sure there's another out there, but off the top of my head, the only 1930s style classic fun house in the world that's heritage listed. And I don't want them to do anything to it, but they can't anyway because it's heritage listed.
Yeah.
And then the only other attractions that are surviving are the Ferris wheel. That's one of the best views in the world. The drop tower hair raiser, as you were talking about earlier, another amazing view. And the Tango train. I don't like the Tango train. But everyone seems to love the Tango train. It's always got a queue. And then the other one, which I don't see going, is the Rota, which it's a newer version of the classic attraction, but a Rota is synonymous with Luna Park.
Yeah.
If you don't know what a Rota is, it's essentially like getting put inside a washing machine and spinning around so fast that you get sucked to the walls. And then the floor drops out from under you and you're still stuck hanging on off the walls, which I think even that, there's not that many. You can watch it, which is one of the best things. You can just like go up and look down on people and people regretting their life decisions that have led to this stage. But I think I'd love to see the park further expand from here. I just don't see where they can.
Well, I think if you try and look at the areas that they have to go, there's a couple of plots of land around Luna Park. Like there's an old railway depot that
exists
nearby.
They'd have to buy more land or be given more land from the
government. However, this is a great stepping stone. If you just go, bam, 9 new attractions, be like, all right, we're going to bring in a new season pass scheme. We're going to make it a ticketed, you know, sort of area. Just try and really bring in some more revenue. Then those, you know, bringing in a little bit more land.
The government might go, okay, you're doing good things here. Have a little bit more land here. Have a little bit more land.
This is either the first step of Luna Park becoming, you know, a nation class. I don't want to say world class. Let's say an Australia class theme park, or the first step to its demise. So it can
hopefully
either go one or two ways from here.
If not, I'm sure we'll get as many rides in on that single rail while we can until it unceremoniously gets moved to another park that it doesn't really fit in. Just like Big Dipper 2 did when it moved to Dreamworld.
We're now on
Big Dipper 3 looks good. Big Dipper 3.
Dig Bipper. Yeah, that one. I think the only other area that they could possibly use is if they remove the big top, but they're not going to remove any function space.
No,
it just makes too much money. Yeah.
Exactly.
They could possibly put temporary attractions in there. That's about it.
That's what I've always thought it'd be a good idea over the busy period, because a big thing with Luna Park is they've always brought in extra attractions during the busy period because they knew that their capacity isn't huge. So they bring in a couple of, you know, different attractions. So in summer, they might bring in a portable log flume or something like that just to bolster their ride lineups. Where all of these used to go, though, is where all the new attractions are going. So they may not be able to do that again unless, like you're saying, they manage to put some of them in the big top, which on a really hot summer's day, like when we went to the park the other day, having somewhere to escape the heat would be spectacular.
Oh,
having somewhere to escape the heat and ride rides at the same time would be even better.
100%. And the other thing I'm thinking, though, just taking this into consideration, if it does go gated, they do need to consider their capacity because Australia has very strict fire laws and fire regulations. There are certain things where you can only have a certain amount of people within queues indoors because they won't let you have too many people in a single space just in case there is a fire and you need to evacuate. The more attractions that they put
this
in...
This is a 2,000 seat theater most of the time. Has the ability to hold 2,000 people. I'm sure it can hold 400 people waiting in a queue.
But I'm thinking about their sort of square footage for the theme park. Like, they're only going to have a certain capacity within the actual navigable areas of the park. So if they hit a point...
I've heard this... like, I've seen the park get up to 2,500, I think.
Oh, nice.
But I believe the park can hold 5,000.
Yeah.
In its current
stage.
Which
is nothing, but...
but it never hits it. If that park... like, the day we were there the other day, I reckon there would have been 600 people in the park.
Oh, yeah. It was dead. There was, like, no one there. So, I think that sort of covers it all off for Luna Park Sydney. Is there anything else that you want to say?
No, I think that it's definitely an exciting time for the park, for sure. I hope that bringing in all these new attractions leads to the success the park is after. I've been lucky enough to, you know, I work there just for a short stint doing some entertainment. We work with them during their Hello Scream event a few years ago, and it had a great atmosphere to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Great people work there. I still know a lot of people who full-time workers there. And I hope that this is the next step for the park and isn't like when the park opened in the 90s as a big hurrah with the new Big Dipper 2.0 and unfortunately led to the demise of the park for almost 10 years. But fingers crossed, it's exciting. I'm sure we'll be there when it reopens in 6 or so months. So hopefully it's worth the wait.
I can imagine us possibly doing an episode when it opens to see if it was all
Stay
worth
tuned
it.
For that.
But until then,
they'll need a new review. The park's going to be so different.
Yeah, true. I think we'll probably end up calling it like Luna Park Sydney Beyond 2021 or something like that. But until then, I'm Dominic Lacey, and you can catch me at, look, just jumping straight into it.
You forgot your name there for a second. Wait, who am I again?
I'm Luke Carroll, and you can reach me at ReviewTimeDom on Twitter.
I am the real Luke Carroll, and you can reach me at ReviewTimeLuke on Twitter.
And both Luke Carrolls can be found at TimeReview on Twitter or ReviewTime anywhere else. And yeah, you can also get in touch with us via email or pretty much anywhere. We're on Instagram.
We're
people message us. We reply, so...
yeah.
Feel free to get in touch.
We've got an exciting topic coming up next week.
Oh, do we?
So make sure to stay tuned for that. We're going to have our first ever Review Time Versus. We're going to take two things and pit them against each other and see who comes out on top. And I think we've got possibly the biggest topic we could ever start with. So make sure you tune in for that next week.
All right. Until then, guys, we will see you on the next Review Time's Theme Podcast. See ya!
See ya!
Review Time's Theme Podcast is brought to you by Luke Carroll and Dominic Lacey. A big shout out goes to our patrons, Jake Cool, Jane McRoberts, Jeremy Kalfakis, Louis Najira, Peter Matthews, Ruben Mays, Luke Shekitano, Ray Dredge, John Madison, Michael Pinn, Janine Kerr, CG Lemonade, Bob Chapek, Tim Descenzo, Josie McDougall, Stephen Schwarzrock, Matt Sakal, Norman Lacey, Sincerely Back, Bobby McDougall, and to you, Bob Chapek. Review Time's Theme Podcast will be back next week.